Welcome to Captivate the Room with your host, internationally known voice expert, Tracy Goodwin, an award-winning speaker who has taught hundreds around the globe to make a big impact with their voice. This podcast is for anyone who wants to step onto a bigger stage, make a bigger impact, and have a voice that makes people listen. Presentation matters, and the voice is the missing link. Join in and you'll see why.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Tracy Goodwin, and I'm so glad you're with me today. You can find out more about me and my work over at CaptivateTheRoom.com. Now, you are in for such a treat today because I have a wonderful guest with me, someone whose work I have really followed and admired for some time. And while I love his work, what is really so special to me about it is that it lines up so closely with the voice work that I do. You are in for such value. So I want you to stay to the very, very end of our conversation. You're just going to love hearing from Peter Bregman, who's with me on the show today. And he's the CEO of Bregman Partners, Inc., a company that strengthens leadership in people and in organizations. He's the host of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, which is it's short conversations with thought leaders focused on ideas that people can use to become more powerful and courageous leaders. Peter's the author of 4 Seconds, All the Time You Need to Replace Counterproductive Habits with Ones That Really Work, which is a New York Post top pick for your career in 2015. And we're going to talk a lot about that book today. It is absolutely wonderful. His previous book was a Wall Street Journal bestseller, 18 Minutes, Find Your Focus, Master Distraction, and Get the Right Things Done. And he's also the author of Point B, A Short Guide to Leading a Big Change. And all of these books are really fantastic. He bases his work on the notion that everyone, no matter their job or level, has the opportunity to lead. Unfortunately, most don't. And there's a massive difference between what we know about leadership and what we do as leaders. What makes leadership hard isn't theoretical, it's practical. It's not about knowing what to say or do. It's about whether you're willing to experience the discomfort, risk, and uncertainty of saying or doing it. And that is so amazing and so much of what we're going to talk about here on the show today. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really fun to be here.
Oh my gosh. I'm so honored that you're here. I love your work. I have really enjoyed following your work. And my greatest challenge today is going to be call this amount of questions down that I have that I want to ask you.
Well, the admiration is mutual. It was really great having you on our podcast. And I'm doing all my voice exercises like you told me to. And I'm enjoying it. So thank you.
And you sound great. You sound great. Well, you always sounded great, but that was fun. I really loved being on the show, and I'm just loving all the great feedback. But let's talk about, you have such an incredible body of work that, you know, it was really hard to cull it down, but I have to tell you, you've got several books, but I am so in love with 4 Seconds that that's where I want to start. Okay, so the 3 books, you've got 4 Seconds, you've got 18 Minutes, and then the third one
is Point B.
Point B.
That was actually the first book that I wrote, Point B, A Short Guide to Leading a Big Change. That book was very much about organizational change and how it was based on the premise that people don't resist change, they resist being changed.
Change
all the time, but if you want to change me, then I'm going to resist it. And if that's true, which I find it to be true, then it suggests that we lead change in a very, very different way in organizations, because leading change by telling people what's in it for them and trying to convince them and appealing to, you know, their self-interest doesn't work very effectively, because they see right through that, and that they know that you're trying to convince them of something, and that immediately creates resistance. What you have to do is you have to leave it up to them, which is a basic premise of everything that I do, which is people have free will and they're going to make choices, and you have to help create an environment that supports the choices that drives forward on the most important work that you're doing. That's what that book's about.
I love that. And when you were saying that, it reminded me of my parents. I remember my mother used to say, well, I've got to make your dad think it's his idea. Right. Now, and we're going to, I want to talk about 4 seconds, but that made me think of something. Do you just work with organizations or do you work with individuals as well?
We work with individuals in organizations, but we're really organization focused. So we don't work with just a standalone individual, but we work with people who are either running organizations or part of organizations. And you know, we used to run a leadership training that was for individuals who came, but we're not really set up for to kind of manage that kind of a business.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I thought. But I know everybody's, at the end of this episode, everybody's going to be like, come on, work with that guy. You know?
thank you. And if they work with organizations, that's a possibility.
Right. Okay, good to know. All right, so when I read 4 seconds, I think 2 pages in, I was already like, oh my gosh, this is so in line with what I do. Totally different field. But when you started early on, page 1 or 2, pause, breathe. Oh my gosh, that's my life. That is a core principle of what I teach.
You know, I could see that completely, because when I think about the voice and I think about, you know, our conversation, which is the authenticity that comes when you're speaking from a grounded, centered place. And it's true for all of leadership, that if we're not grounded, if we're reacting to what other people are doing, not only will our voices be high and thin, but so will our ideas, and so will our approach, and so will our relationships. And so, you know, to have really solid, I mean, it's actually very interesting. I never really thought about this until now and until our conversation and thinking about your work and my work. But, you know, if you want to be, you know, the voice reflects reality. And mm-hmm. So if you want to have a grounded voice, you have to be a grounded person.
Yes.
And you have to be thoughtful and strategic about what it is you're trying to achieve and why you're trying to achieve it and what your values are and what you care about and what's important in this moment. And if you have that, you can slow down enough in order to be thoughtful and intentional and centered. And it doesn't take long, actually. I mean, you're not rewriting your mission statement in every conversation. There's a period where you have to be sort of thoughtful about what am I going for here? What am I trying to achieve? That's a basic premise of walking through the world with, you know, a sense of who you are and why. Mm-hmm. But when you're grounded in that, it does take reminding. And the reminding could be, you know, someone says something and it raises it shoots a stimulus into your amygdala and your reptilian brain, you know, lights up, and you know, someone yells at you and you want to yell back and you take a breath, which slows down the whole response. And, you know, you feel your feet on the ground and you ask yourself, kind of, who am I in this moment? What is the outcome that I want to achieve? And what's the smartest way of getting there? So it's a slowing down process.
Well, I love that you said react. You know, it's react versus respond.
Right.
And they're two totally different things, right?
Right.
You know, I mean, I call it breathing reset. And you even mentioned the word reset in the book. It's that reset. Hold on a minute, you know, but do you find in your work that people are, I know the answer in my work, but do you find when you go into these organizations that are just in humans in general, we are reactionary?
Oh, for sure. The best leaders are not.
Okay.
So the best leaders, the leaders that I know or that I work with, and we work on this specifically, but it's really impressive to me because I think they have a skill beyond mine in many cases where they're very clear on what's important. You know, there's a phrase, I spent the weekend a few weekends ago with some amazing people, Alan Mulally, who is the CEO of Ford and before that Boeing, and Jim Kim, who's the president of the World Bank, and Marshall Goldsmith, who's a executive coach extraordinaire. And I left a bunch of conversations with them with this one phrase that's in my mind that is I sort of a guiding principle now, which is it's not that complicated. Like there's so many situations we go into and we get twisted up in the various issues and feelings and people and dynamics and politics. But in reality, if you know what it is, you know, if you have some values that you hold very strongly and you have a general process for how you want to operate and you have some beliefs and a clear outcome that you're going for, then you take that deep breath and it's not that complicated.
Yeah.
It's not that complicated. If you believe in transparency and people are telling you secrets and you really have a firm belief in transparency, it's not that complicated. The answer is speak to the people who are involved in this and speak openly in front of everybody so that we can resolve this as a group and we can move forward with care and commitment to each other as a team.
Yeah.
It's not that complicated. Now, it might be hard. It might be emotionally challenging. You might need emotional courage. It might be uncomfortable, but it's not that complicated. And if you can stand really strongly in that, then responding as opposed to reacting becomes second nature, even though it may never be easy. Now, yeah. I remember I was in a meeting recently and I had said something. The CEO had asked me a question. He'd asked me privately when he and I were just in the room, he'd asked me something about, you know, what I thought about some element of the team. And I told him, and there was nothing that was confidential about it, but it kind of had that feeling of, you know, you're asking me my opinion about the team and I'm going to share it with you. And I don't know, I had a slightly uncomfortable feeling when I was sharing it with him, but I didn't say anything that I wouldn't stand in and believe in, but I, you know, I had that feeling. So then we were in a meeting with all of his direct reports and it was part of the conversation. He goes, look, I was talking to Peter earlier, you know, and he said about blah, 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 blah about this team. And I found my face getting red and and it was fine. Actually, there was nothing, but in my head, I was not being transparent. And I really respected that he did that in a way. I mean, it felt like, you know, it's a reminder for me that everything I say should be, and this might be controversial, but everything I say should be able to be said publicly.
Yeah.
And if there's something I'm going to say that I can't stand behind publicly, then I shouldn't be saying it. And the way you help organizations move together as a collective is by relying on that kind of transparency, because as soon as secrets start being told and then people are hiding and then they're developing different kinds of alliances and, you know, who's on my side, then the whole organization begins to fall apart and it becomes a political mess. So, you know, I need to be reminded of that sometimes, but it's a sense that if that's your value, if transparency is your value, and it's not going to be everybody's value, but if it's your value and it's my value, and I believe that organizations function much more effectively when people are open and honest with each other with care and with appreciation, but that's how you build trust. Even if they're hard messages, that's how you build trust. That's how you know someone is trustworthy. Then I got to stand behind that. And if I know that that's a guiding principle, then when there's an opportunity, I have to take a deep breath and I have to say, like, you know, is there something true here that I need to share openly that I know will be shared or that I will be okay with having it shared broadly?
Yeah.
And I think organizations can be really helped and people can be really helped with that kind of clarity of values that allows them to respond instead of react.
Oh, definitely. And everything you are saying lines up with the core principles that I teach in relation to voice. I mean, that whole thing that you just said was so beautiful. And the whole time in my head, I was thinking, my tagline is speak your truth, just do it beautifully.
Right.
You know, and that's,
I love that.
What I hear you saying,
that's
get in your body, know your truth, say it, but don't vomit it all out all over everybody in anger or frustration or hostility. And, you know, as you're talking about this, I was also thinking about a story you talk about in the book with your wife and you being late for dinner. And I can't help but think this is obviously great for leadership and business, but this has to be a huge boost to relationships.
Yeah. I mean, if you're keeping secrets in your relationship, you're just asking for, even if it's a long-term relationship, you're asking for a slow alienation that can't end with anything but demise unless unless you break through it. And the longer the secret gets held, the harder it becomes to really show up in your truth. And it's scary. And so, you know, it's why I talk a lot about emotional courage, which is we need to be willing to feel things if we want to show up as true leaders. We need to be willing to say things that other people may not like and to say it, as you said, beautifully as we can say it, with care and with love. And I use that word. I mean, I think that we, you know, like if we're on a team, we have to show care and love to the other people on the team. Even if there's something we dislike, even if we have a problem, that then you show up and you share that with care and with love and with skill.
Yeah.
In a way that allows it to be discussed and moved through. And then the relationship can only get stronger. And that's true for families. It's true with your children and your parents. It's true with friends, you know, and it's true in organizations, because ultimately, you know, it's funny at the beginning when you asked me, do I speak with individuals? Do I work with individuals or just organizations? I really view organizations as a collective of individuals who are trying to get something accomplished together. And I don't, you know, the organization as an entity doesn't stand separate from the group of individuals who are running that organization or who are trying to work effectively in that organization. So I really think the human aspect of the organization is the critical piece to make it.
Oh, for sure. And I hear what I hear you say in that is communication is so key, but yet can be so challenging. Why do we struggle to say what we need to say? Is it that, and I love emotional courage. I love that phrase. That made me think of vulnerability. Why is it so darn hard to say, look, I'd really appreciate it if you wouldn't get on my computer when I'm not here, or whatever's going on in these spaces that you go into?
Right. It's a great question. And it's because we're insecure. And because we, it's not that we don't have the skill to do it, because we have the skill to do it. I mean, if we slow down, right? So that we're not vomiting all over everybody. But, you know, ultimately we have to be willing to experience shame or embarrassment or rejection or disapproval. And we have a very, very hard time with that. I mean, if you want to say exactly why, it's because when we were really young kids and we experienced that, the feeling when we were really young kids and our parents might have scolded us or told, you know, tried to get us in shape, or our caregivers, that ultimately that was a life or death issue. It was literally a life or death issue. Meaning if I was going to be abandoned by my parents, I would not be able to survive. So I learned to be the nice guy, or I learned to be the accommodating, or I learned all of these skills that we all learn that are indispensable for survival when we're four.
Yeah.
Right. But are not so useful when we're 40.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So, and yet, you know, we hold on to them. So we have to separate from those to a certain degree. We have to sort of be willing to feel things that would have been very, very dangerous for us to feel 40 years ago or 50 years ago, but now are not so dangerous for us to feel. And we can actually survive them. And we need some experience surviving them. But, you know, why don't we do it? If I'm being nice, I'll say, because you're nice and I don't want to offend you and I don't want to say something that's going to be hurtful for you. But if I'm being honest, what I would say is I don't want to experience your rejection or disapproval, and I don't want to experience what it would be like if you were mad at me. And so I'm just going to put up with it because, you know, I don't have the courage to say what needs to be said, or I haven't spent the time to think about how to say it in a way that reflects my care and love, or I don't feel that care and love. And so I've got to get to a place where I can feel it before I share it. Otherwise it won't land.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that answer. And you even talk about in the book, reflect.
Right.
Reflect, resist, replace.
Right.
I believe we're the three, right?
Yep. Yep. You have to take a pause. That's what the reflect is. Pause for not long, 4 seconds. That's the title of the book.
Yeah.
That's the amount of time you need in order to take a deep breath. It's actually really twice the amount of time that you need. To Josh Gordon, who's a Dr. Josh Gordon, who's a friend of mine, and he was, when I spoke with him about this, he was a professor at Columbia, and now he's at the, I think he's the director of the NIH. But he was a neuroscientist, and he told me that, you know, the situation I described before, where you get an amygdala impulse, something happens, someone yells at you and you get this reptilian brain response. The goal is to slow down enough for the response to go from your amygdala, which is at the back of your brain, base of your brain, to your neocortex, which is the thinking part of the brain. It's up towards the front of the brain, and it's the part that makes logical, thoughtful, intentional choices. So you need to get enough time to respond with your neocortex, not your amygdala. You need about a second or two to do that. So I was super generous when I said 4 seconds. Make it easy for people. You know, I'll give them twice the amount of time that they really need. And so you need enough time to pause, right? Which is the reflect piece. And then you need to resist the temptation to respond the way you would habitually respond. And that's hard. It's hard because we're used to those responses, because those are the things that we have always been taught to do, and those are the things that we do. And if I'm not, if I don't resist the urge, right, to act in a way that I've habitually acted, then I'm just going to vomit all over people. So you have to reflect, you have to resist. And then you need something to replace it with. You need some response that could almost be automatic, but it could follow a few seconds of thought that you replace. So if you yell at me and I immediately get a shot of adrenaline and my amygdala is lit up and I'm about to respond, so I've got to pause long enough, I could take a deep breath, and I could resist the urge to yell back. And then I could replace that normal habitual response with a more effective one. And in this case, it might be to ask a question. So, you know, I might, instead of yelling back or defending myself or running away or shutting down or whatever reaction I might have, if you're yelling at me, I would pause, I would breathe. And then I might think, okay, you know, what's the outcome I want here? I might ask that question so I could think about what it is I'm trying to do. And it might be questions. I might just, my new response to being yelled at might be to ask questions. Wow, you're really mad. What's going on? Tell me more about what did I do? What, you know, like what are you angry about? Like, slow everything down.
Yeah.
Slow everything down by asking questions and getting them to respond. And then you could be in a conversation. You can show up much more reasonably than you would if you yelled back. And it actually buys you time to understand the situation and figure out what you need to do with it.
Well, and what a gift, not only to yourself, but to the other person.
Absolutely.
You know, and I just, what I hear you talking about just sounds like the perfect storm for gossip, which will just, I think, decimate a workplace, right?
Right. You know, one of the things that I talk about in terms of changing a culture in an organization is that you have to do dramatic, story-worthy things that people will talk about. And that could either be negative or it could be positive. So if someone yells at you, I remember at the very, very beginning, 20 years ago, when I was first starting Bregman Partners, when I was first starting my consulting firm, and I got a big project and we had, you know, maybe 50, 70 coaches working on it and a bunch of consultants, and we had people all over the world. And it was the first very, very big project that I'd run, and it was my company, and I, you know, I was scared and having a hard time with it. And this one coach, we were in a room with maybe 12 coaches, and I was talking about the way the project was shifting. And this one coach lost it on me. And he was probably 15 years my senior. And so I was 30, he might've been 50, he might've been 45, he might've been 50, 15 to 20 years, my senior, I just started my company. And he, you know, he, in front of everybody, lost it. And I remember sitting there listening to him in this strangely calm stance. Like I was sitting there, I was listening to him, and he was yelling, everybody was silent, everybody was watching. And I remember, actually feeling my feet on the ground. And I remember thinking to myself, this might be the most important moment in my company. At least it is up to this point, because what he's yelling about doesn't actually matter. What matters is I've got, you know, however many people there were around the table, 15 people who work for me, who were all watching for how I respond. Mm. How I respond to his being really upset about something is going to be the story that they talk about. Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, it might be the story they talk about might be, oh, wow, he really lost it on Peter. But what they're really going to be focused on. So I thought, you know, how do I want to respond? Like, given what I'm hearing from him, So I took the time while he was yelling at me, I was listening to him and I was thinking about how to respond. And some people might say you shouldn't think about how to respond. You should just listen. But if anyone's been in front of, you know, 15 other people while one person yells at you, listening is fine. But you also have to think about, you know, how do I want to respond in this situation? Or at least that was my experience. And I was able to think about what are my values? How do I want to run this company? And what does that suggest I should do in terms of this response? And I don't know why I was so calm in that moment and why it was so clear to me. But, you know, the answer was I wanted to respond with empathy. Like, I don't know how I was going to resolve the issue, but I wanted to make sure that I responded in a way where he felt heard. Because whatever he was upset about, he was very upset about. And I did not need to solve it in that room, but I needed him to feel heard. And then we could figure out a solution afterwards. And I think that's really sort of been the tone of the company since. And so I think you know, thinking about what prompted this was your suggestion that, you know, we're doing a gift for the other person. It's not just the other person. We have a gift to everybody around us, everyone in the family, everyone who's around us, who's saying, what is the tone that this person's setting and how are they responding? And is it safe to be here?
Yes.
Which is ultimately the question that everybody's asking.
Oh my gosh. Do you see why I wanted him on the show? This is incredible. This is golden. Can you imagine if everybody could respond this way? How different everything would be. You know, it's just wonderful. And I could just go on and on and on with this conversation, but I want to jump over to talk about your TED Talks. Is it four?
I've done four.
And that's, you know, I had followed your work. I had listened to your podcast. Peter has a wonderful podcast, The Bregman Leadership Show. I've been on the show. It's wonderful. But then I stumbled onto your TED Talks, and that's when I said, I'm going to email him because I was so impressed with him. Now, how was that a goal to be on, do TED Talks, or how did that all happen?
People reached out and asked if I would do it, and I said yes.
Yeah.
It was not a goal. I mean, I didn't reach out to anybody.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. Was it great? Was it wonderful? Yeah, what was it like?
You know, they were hard. Each one got easier. But, you know, if you said to me, okay, you have 2 hours to talk about something, I don't need to prepare. But if you told me I have 18 minutes to talk about something, you know, and it was, you know, at the time also, you know, my first TED Talk. I mean, you know, TED was such a big deal. And so I really was stressed out and I wanted to get it perfect. And I, you know, kind of wrote it out and rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it. And I've sort of written about how difficult it was for me to, you know, how spun around I got around trying to make this thing perfect. By my last TED Talk, by my fourth TED Talk, I had a general idea of what I wanted to talk about and I knew how I wanted to frame it and I talked about it. I mean, you know, and that I think went better. But it's because I'm not really such a memorizer I like things when they feel more authentic than and some people are really, really great. I mean, you work with actors in part who, you know, have to be incredibly authentic with memorized lines.
Yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
So that's, you know, that's really, really powerful. I don't know that I have that skill as much. But they were, you know, they were super fun. I mean, you really, you know, in the end, when you think about it, in 18 minutes, you've got one idea that you can share and make it interesting.
Yeah, I would think that would be the greatest challenge is that 18 minute thing.
Right. That's what, for me, that was the greatest challenge. It was saying, how do I want to use this very limited amount of time?
Yeah. Well, and I know you do a lot of speaking beyond the TED Talks, but that's what struck me so much when I saw those videos was I thought, he's a really good speaker. You know, I'm pretty hardcore on that, you know? And I thought, God, I just really love watching him speak. What is it that you think makes a good speaker?
You know, I think I think there's some combination of being articulate, being passionate, and being very in touch with the audience, in effect. I mean, you could be very passionate and completely lose your audience. because, mm-hmm. you know, you're not really speaking to them. But ultimately it's, you know, do I have an idea I really care about that I want to convey to people? Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, I choose the word convey intentionally, right? Because it's not just, do I have an idea I want to articulate, or it's not just, do I have an idea that I want to express, right? It's really like, what is the impact I want to have on people? And how do I share my enthusiasm for this in a way that leaves them feeling it as well as understanding it? And I think that's what makes a TED Talk really good, is that it, you know, it appeals and connects emotionally with people, as opposed to, you know, just sort of something intellectually that's very interesting and you go, huh, that was really interesting.
Yeah.
So I think it's like, keep it simple and keep it interesting. I think, you know, early on in my career, I used to really think about how to be funny, because I thought that was the, you know, that was the key to making a good talk. I like funny speakers.
Yeah.
But I actually think I'm much funnier when I don't intend to be.
Right.
That's a good thing or a bad thing. But it's, you know, if I'm really in relationship, actually a woman who worked for me once told me this when I was preparing for a speech, and I said, is it funny enough? And her answer was, it doesn't need to be funny. You know, you need to be real. Like, you need to connect, but you don't need to be funny.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I'm not a comedian, but that helped me to sort of say, okay, I'm going to be real and I'm going to share ideas, and hopefully they'll be moving for people, and I'll do it in a way, the best way I know how, that can touch them emotionally as well as intellectually.
Yeah. But that's wonderful. And, you know, but I hear you also saying that you really considered the audience. What does the audience need? What do I have that they need that can create the impact, the greatest connection?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that may be the mistake that some people make, is it's, what do I have to offer? What is it, you know, what do I have? What can I teach? But it really, what I hear you saying is that the audience is so, so key in making that decision as you picked your topics.
Right. It's almost like, what experience do I want to have the audience have about, you know, my topic? Like, what is the experience I want them to have? And given who they are, how do I give them that experience?
Yeah. Wow. That's so, so awesome. This is just, you know, like I say, I could go on and on. I wrote up 2 pages worth of questions. You could have written up so many more, because you're just such a wealth of valuable information. And not just, I know you're a leadership expert, but this is life stuff. You know, I hear you talking life stuff to me today, Peter.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And yeah, I mean, I think life and leadership are very, very similar. Like, I think that, you know, how we show up, I know very few leaders who show up really powerfully as great leaders and really, really poorly in their lives. Like, I think you're, you know, how you show up, how you lead an organization should be similar in many ways to how you lead your life. And the standard should be the same. Mm. You know, sort of, what are your values and do you live up to those values? And that's hard, but it's, you know, ultimately, if you think about it, again, an organization is just a gaggle of relationships who are collectively trying to achieve a common objective.
So true.
And I don't know that that's so different than a family, right?
Yeah, right.
Sort of very similar to a family. So,
do we all have it in us? I mean, that's kind of maybe that's a hot button question.
But. No, I think it's a great question. And I think the answer is absolutely. Absolutely, we all have it in us. And I actually think, you know, Michelangelo has this great quote, which is when he was asked about David, how he's, you know, creates David. He goes, I don't create David. David's already in the rock. I just have to chip away at the rough-hewn stone to reveal its apparition, right? Like, so David's in there, and we got to get all the other stuff out of the way in order to be able to see the sculpture David, that he's envisioned in this rock, that he's seen in the rock. Mm. And I think we're very much like that. Like, I think everybody has this capability. And there are so many layers of gunk over many of us that prevent us from showing up that way. Most really young kids have this. They're free, they're creative, they can get mad, and then they can stop getting mad. And, you know, like, I remember seeing this. I remember I remember very, very early on, I was actually a student in college and I was with a family and it was like a little kid birthday party. It might've been a 2-year-old birthday party or 3-year-old birthday party. And one of the kids like really like hit and pushed another kid. And my, you know, young adult self looked at it and was like outraged and like, where the hell is that mother and or father? And, you know, like I want someone to lash out. And 30 seconds later, those two kids were holding hands and walking around. And I was, you know, I was like astounded. Like, how did they get over it that fast? Like, I'm still pissed at this kid. Like, I don't know either of them. And I'm still pissed at this kid. For what another kid. But they're fine.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think to get back to that, to free ourselves from the layers of, yeah. of, you know, habit and hurt and challenge and relationship disappointment that we have in order to then, you know, show up and be clean and let things go and not require everybody to be perfect and not require, you know, ourselves to be perfect. I think it's in us. It's in every single one of us. And we have to, you know, our job is to remove some of those layers.
Yeah. And that's exactly the same thing as the voice. Look at a 4-year-old. They're using melody. They're making bold choices. They're saying what they need to say. Give me a 40-year-old doing that. I want to meet him. Right. And it's the same thing. It's the layers, the dings, the protection, the caution, the this, that. And it's like, I tell people all the time, I'm just taking you back to where you started. And I think that's kind of what you're doing too. You're just taking them back to one.
Right. And you know, different cultures are different too. There's certain, you know, I think American male culture is generally the most American male heterosexual culture. American white male heterosexual culture is probably the most monotone of all cultures. I might get slammed for saying this, but it's like, that's been my experience. And so, you know, but you go to Puerto Rico or, you know, you go to Italy or, you know, you go to various other countries and people are much more expressive and much more, you know, have the melodies and the rhythms and the, and so I think it's cultural too. It's sort of what's become acceptable for the culture in which we live and how do we break out of the, you know, inhibitions that imprison us to be able to show up expressively, like, the, you know, to have the impact that we want to have.
Oh yeah. It goes back to that emotional courage in many ways and link it to bold choices and you're going to be a game changer. You're just a game changer.
Right. I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, this has just been wonderful. And, you know, I want listeners, please go check out Peter's books, 4 Seconds. You can look it up on Amazon. I highly recommend all of them, but 4 Seconds is just, it's just magical. It just so lines up with everything that I talk about. And then we've got the podcast, the Bregman Leadership Show, right? The podcast.
Yeah. The Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Tons of incredible, incredible articles on Peter's website. Is Peter, tell us where to, tell us where to find us.
Sure. PeterBregman.com. PeterBregman.com. And you can find everything there.
Everything's there. And I will put that in the show notes. And if you are with an organization, take this podcast and play it for your leaders. Play it. Let them know that this is great, great stuff. And then you'll have Peter's website, you know how to find him and bring him in so that you have an opportunity to get back to one. And that's what it's all about. That's what, there is so much freedom there. So Peter, thank you so much. I know how busy you are and I just value your time. And thank you for sharing so much wonderful, wonderful value with us today.
It's such a pleasure. I'm a big fan of you and your work and you've helped me. I'm doing my exercises every day, 3 times. And it's been really fun. So thanks for having me on the show.
Awesome. And thank you, listeners. You know how much I appreciate and value you, your downloads and shares. And that's it for today. So until I see you next time, you know what to do. Get out there and speak your truth. Just do it beautifully.